I had to start recording.
Most of mathematics is done because it's interesting and fits together as a unified subject, rather than because you're trying to solve a physical problem of some kind, like building a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
The mathematics that's used in building a bridge is mathematics that's been known for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not basically new research type mathematics. It's very useful and legitimate mathematics, and you want to study it, perhaps, but you frequently don't work on that kind of problem. Most of the mathematicians at the University of Wisconsin are not in what's called applied mathematics. They're in what's often called pure mathematics, which is just doing mathematics for its own sake. Now, it may be applicable at some time later. You may find physics is now using a lot of the work that was done in Lie algebras, which was certainly not done in order to be useful to physicists. It was done for its own sake, just because it was an interesting pattern that you studied as a pattern, and not because you were trying to do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know whether that's what humanities really means or not, but to some extent it is to me. That is, you study beautiful things.
Well, that seems to be one of the criteria.
One of the criteria for me is that it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I think the problems that I'm working on in mathematics, for the most part, are concerned with very abstract kinds of situations. You are looking at a space, which is you're imagining some set on which you have an idea of what is near something else built into it, and you describe what happens in this space, how it fits together, and many of the natural problems that you can ask cannot be solved within the usual framework that you can actually prove that the problems cannot be solved unless you are making assumptions that we don't know that you can make. So it becomes very philosophical.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like doing pure philosophy. I grew up in a tiny town in Texas that was tremendously isolated. You had to ford the river 7 times to get out of the canyon in which the town was located, and it was a 50-mile trip over a 1-lane dirt road. So you didn't go very often, and I went from having very little experience with what goes on in the outside world to the University of Texas, where...
Well, you said you'd gone to a very primitive high school.
Right. There were 4 people in the graduating class in the high school, and so it didn't offer many courses, and it didn't raise your horizons very much.
Did you have any horizons when you finished?
I knew I wanted to go to the university.
Mm-hmm. But not in what?
But not what I wanted to study, or had. And I found the university tremendously exciting, and I took courses in a wide range of subjects. I took the beginning course in absolutely everything and thoroughly enjoyed it. I found it I loved the rare books collection, and I loved the things that they were doing in the drama school, and I took a lot of English courses and a lot of philosophy courses and a lot of history courses, and I think I minored in Spanish. And I had a lot of the beginning science courses without going very deep into them because I wanted to know a little bit of something about a lot of things. And I was at the same time taking mathematics courses, and the man who registered me when I was a freshman, because it was his technique of choosing of finding students to go and try to find anyone who was good at using language, that they understood what a sentence said. You had an if-then sentence, if this, then that. You have certain implications that you mean and others that you don't mean. What and or really mean, they have very technical meaning in mathematics, and if you use these words well, I know that that was one of the things that he watched for. I can't imagine what he saw in me as a 16-year-old that made him think that I should study mathematics. But because I wanted to take trigonometry, he taught trigonometry. And he also taught me in analytical geometry, and he also taught me in calculus, and he also taught me in advanced calculus.
Now, wait a minute.
And so this man very quickly decided that here is someone who has potential to be a mathematician. He picked out a student in a course in geometry, more or less at the same time, that he was teaching for high school teachers in the summertime. He found a man who had been teaching high school for 10 years, who was going back to the university to become a principal, was his aim at that point. And he found that he was very good at handling mathematics problems, even though he'd essentially never seen any. And the teacher's technique was to not let you read anything. You were to do mathematics. He would feed you problems that were just a little harder than you could easily do, and you would work on these problems and solve them, and then you would get more interesting ones that were harder, and you would get more interesting ones that were harder, but he essentially forced you to reproduce as much of the known mathematics as he knew, in a way. He was a very well-known mathematician. He had been president of the American Mathematical Society. He had been one of the early colloquium lecturers for the American Mathematical Society. He had done a good deal of writing and had published a lot. He was a very well-known mathematician, but he was tremendously interested in teaching, and he looked for people that didn't know anything, essentially, and trained them. And he was very successful at it. I don't understand how. I can't teach a course in the way that he did. I can't keep from telling students things. I've never really tried. In fact, I had a PhD and knew very, very little. And I've suffered from that all of my life, because I've every time I want to really know anything about mathematics, I have to now go read about it like a graduate student should do, and I should have done it very early in life, and I didn't. So that the only tool I really got out of graduate school with was the absolute confidence that I could solve anything. He built your ego to a point where you thought you could handle mathematics. And you had experience with looking at problems that had been unsolved, lots of problems. And you felt perfectly confident that you could sit down and solve them. And many of our graduate students don't, they go through and they take courses and they make A's. But they don't know how to really sit down with a problem which they know is unsolved and look for another problem close to it and solve this one and look at the next one. That's what a mathematician has to do. That's what a grown-up mathematician does, is to solve such problems and to find others that are interesting and that fit in and that you build in this kind of way. And we have never really learned how to teach our students to build in this way. We show them how to prove a theorem, and we give them a tremendous amount of background in proved theorems. On the other hand, we don't give them a lot of practice in doing it themselves. I think a historian has the same kind of problem. That is, his students take tests, didn't do well in them. They learned how to learn history, but they don't necessarily learn how to look at history and decide what is important and what the what an interesting thread running through it is, and to have ideas about how certain things fit together and what might be something interesting to trace. The ideas behind it, not just the actual looking it up in a book kind of thing, are quite different.
Do you think this can be taught? One tends to think that the...
I know almost no one who knows how to do it, but I did know one man who knew how to do it. The man that I worked with did know how to do that, and his students, he was tremendously successful when he was successful. That is, his students who left the University of Texas with a PhD and no training at all in mathematics, except training in doing it. They didn't know the standard theorems, they didn't know a wide variety, they didn't have a broad background, they had a very shallow, narrow background, which they had essentially built themselves. And the ones that were very good, and he had a talent for picking out people who could be very good. There were a remarkable number of his students who became really first-class research mathematicians. But they were almost good in direct proportion to how fast they left this training and started to read and started to accumulate background and knowledge in perhaps an entirely different area. This, together with their confidence that they could do something, made them very good. Mm-hmm. And I really feel like it's sinful not to have ever read anything in mathematics, and not to have ever, that is, students really should learn. The time you can learn most easily is when you are a graduate student, when you're in a position where you have to pass exams and do this kind of thing, and he just managed to make it so that you really didn't have to do a lot of those things. And so I don't really think it's the best possible way to teach. But it is true that I had this kind of training, and that...
And you might not have been a mathematician.
I might not. I'm almost surely wouldn't have been a mathematician without it. Mm-hmm. In my senior year in college, I went into the bureau that gave tests on aptitude to help you find out what you should do in life. And I hadn't really given the matter much serious thought. I had just been going to the university, taking everything I could find. And I went in and said, but now I'm about to graduate. What do you think I should do to earn a living? And they said, well, we'll give you some tests. And they did. And I came in and they said, you're kidding. You're putting us on. They're going to ask you to stay here and teach and go to school, in graduate school in mathematics. You obviously have tremendous talent there, and you should obviously do that. That is, it would be a mistake to say no when they ask you. And a couple of weeks later, they invited me to stay and be a TA and go to graduate school in mathematics. But I had not really thought of doing that. It hadn't occurred to me as a possibility, even.
Well, tell me briefly, if you can, were your parents, what was their influence on your mind?
My parents valued education very much. My mother had gone to Vanderbilt and Peabody, and my father had gone to the University of Texas and was an engineer who worked for the State Highway Department. And both of their mothers had gone to girls finishing schools, which they thought of as college, and had had more education than the average woman at their mm-hmm. time, and in the middle 1800s. And they thought that education was very important.
Yeah. So
I'm sure that had some influence mm-hmm. on my choosing to do graduate.
Yeah. Well, or
do research and being a mathematician after I got married.
Mm-hmm. All right, but you come to the University of Texas, and you say this teacher, did he examine all his students?
No, but he taught a great many elementary courses and looked for people in those courses whom he thought were talented.
I see. And then those he singled out.
And those he singled out and devoted a tremendous amount of time and energy to, of which you were unaware until later.
Mm-hmm.
I really was unconscious of the fact that I was being primed, which is incredible to me now.
It is. And he never said anything to
He never really said anything to me until later.
Mm-hmm. So you might, in fact, have decided that you would major in English
or
Spanish
yes.
as a
right.
junior.
Right. I might very well.
He never
He really didn't nudge me, except that he made interesting things available for me. And I didn't have a fantastic number of mathematics courses. I had plenty to make a major, but I didn't have our students that are really talented in mathematics. Most of them take half their courses in mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't do that at all.
I'm curious, do you think your other courses, history, philosophy, did they contribute, do you think, at all to your ability to do math?
I don't know. As I say, the mathematics which I do now is very close to being mathematical logic.
Mm-hmm.
And I did take a lot of philosophy courses.
It would probably be the other way around. You'd be better at philosophy because you were a good mathematician.
I don't know to what extent they influenced me in mathematics.
You read that the math genius is discovered around the age of, 8, 12?
Frequently.
How many of the people who teach in a university are of that sort?
Not as many as you think. Most of the mathematicians in the math department, and I talk to mathematicians all over the country, I think most of them were not child prodigies in mathematics. The child prodigy in mathematics, the kid who does super well on tests and who there are a lot of mathematics high school achievement things in mathematics where you can take tests, and they're called the Olympiad, for instance. They have, you can take some tests in your school and then some tests that where you compete with kids from many other schools. Who didn't want to do it at that time in life, who become very good mathematicians.
Just as good, in fact.
Yes, just as good. And are more apt, while usually people who are good in mathematics were good in high school, too, they're not the people who were necessarily the super ones.
Uh-huh.
There's some sort of lasting quality which is necessary, which isn't necessarily part of doing problems well, of a problem solver in high school.
Well, that's interesting, because I had understood that mathematicians, like athletes, burned out early.
Yeah. Frequently, the best mathematics that a person does is done fairly early in life. But fairly early in life is 5 years after the PhD, and not at 13.
Yeah.
there are a number of there are a couple of brothers right now who are really super mathematicians who were both very good, very young. There are clearly examples of that, where someone who was really talented in mathematics got started and was well trained very early, and who did a lot of their best work very early.
Mm-hmm.
But there are plenty of examples of people who were equally good who didn't follow that pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll bet that not more than three or four of the mathematicians at the university here were really super sure they wanted to major in mathematics when they went to the university. Mm. That is, that's something they discovered while taking courses in the university, that they were interested in mathematics.
So the teacher must be important.
The teacher is tremendously important for that reason.
And good mathematicians aren't necessarily good teachers, I suppose.
Oh, no, not at all.
That never seems to be necessarily the case.
Right. The ability to do mathematics and the ability to teach are completely separate talents. You do have to know something in order to teach. Mm-hmm. That is, just I'm teaching a course at the moment for elementary school teachers. And I'm dismayed at how little mathematics they know and how unsure they are about what sentences really mean. And it's sort of frightening to me that they will be teaching mathematics to elementary school students, even though they're very good teachers and very conscientious and have ideas about how you might teach mathematics. At the same time, they really don't know enough material to enrich it, to make it exciting, I think.
And you probably can't convey this to them in the course one semester.
It's two-thirds of a semester that they're required to take.
It's really a lifetime.
I suspect, actually, they will learn their mathematics while they're teaching. That is, they will see these problems in the books year after year, and they will get books out of the library that have more interesting problems in them, and they will learn to solve them, and they will learn on the job. I hope they do. That's definitely, you do not decide in advance that I will do problem 1, 2, 3, 4 in that order, because they all fit together and it would make such a beautiful theory. You learn all sorts of things about mathematics, and you decide this problem is maybe something. You run across a problem in one way or another. You are working on something else and you discover that you don't know something that you would like to know something about.
Could you give an example of a something?
For instance, if you are teaching a class at the university and you are explaining how to do to prove a theorem that someone proved a long time ago, perhaps, and you see that there's a natural question which someone should have asked and maybe did ask at that time, but they didn't get anywhere with it, but that there is a hole in what is known, and you don't know whether it's been done or whether it hasn't been done or whether anyone has looked at it or not, but you begin to worry about could there possibly be if I added this extra condition, could I then classify the set of all spaces that satisfy such and such a condition? And you try to see if you can do it. You may even try to look up something in the literature and see if something has been done on it before. And you then decide, this looks like a really interesting question. I know some tools that may be useful with that. I will try to solve it. And you start to work on it. And you may find that you can do it in a day, in which case it isn't terribly interesting. It's just you have answered that question and you put it aside and you fall across another question. Someone may write you a letter saying, do you know how to do such and such? Or you may be reading a research article and they point out that something is still unsolved in the area where they're working, and you may feel that you have tools that will handle this problem. And as you are working on one problem, you also think of a different problem that looks like it would fit right in. And among all the problems that you see, and you see hundreds of them in a semester, you will find that you pick out some of them which you think are particularly ones that you're interested in and that you would like to work on, and you start to spend time on them. But if something can be done in 2 or 3 days, it's not very hard and it's not very interesting. It's usually the things that take 6 months or a year or maybe 5 years or maybe 25 years, and you remember these problems that you've spent lots of time on, and you come back to them again and you look at them again. And I think most mathematicians do essentially what my husband does. He keeps a collection of problems, which he doesn't set them aside, he doesn't organize them, saying these are the 6 problems I'm working on now, mm-hmm. but the fact is that he has a certain number of problems that he's actually looking at whenever he gets an idea to look at. I often, however, choose, and maybe it was part of my training of being given a specific problem to look at one at a time, I usually have one problem that I think of as my problem and the problem I'm looking at, and I have to be convinced that it within myself that it's tremendously interesting and important to work on, that to solve it positively or negatively would be a tremendous contribution. I have to sell myself on the problem, but once I've sold myself that it's really important to do, then I will devote lots of time and energy to it. And one problem, someone, a friend of mine in 1950, sent me a postcard saying, do you know how to do, did you know that this was an interesting question, and do you know how to solve it? And I looked at it, and I, within a few days, actually, was able to say that if another problem could be solved, then this problem could be solved. Mm-hmm. And that problem has become more and more central with the years, partly because it remained unsolved except for this partial solution of mine. And in 1970, I actually solved the problem. I found a counterexample to the what was hoped to be a theorem. You can add all sorts of additional conditions which might lead to a theorem. And I've shown that certain ones of them are independent of the usual axioms for set theory, that is, that they cannot be decided. Certain other ones can be decided and can be decided positively. Others can be decided and can be decided negatively. So that there is one problem that I have for 30 years made little contributions to at various times. Other areas, I'll get started on a problem in them, and I'll perhaps do all I can do there, and that's the end of it. I won't look back at them again. But most problems I find, I look back at again and again, doing something different with them each time. And when I'm doing something else that has applications there, when I learn something else, I can frequently use it on another problem that I have looked at some time. And so you resurrect old problems, and you get certain areas where you're the expert. Almost everyone, every mathematician has some little narrow area where you are the person who knows all of the problems that are there and is most apt to take a technique which occurs somewhere else and apply there in an effective way.
This is worldwide.
Hmm. Yeah.
So people write to you when they...
When they have something, they write to you. Mm-hmm. I have tremendous amount of correspondence with people who've worked on the same kinds of problems at various times.
I gather from your failure to state the problem that you feel it just wouldn't mean anything.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That is...
That's very tantalizing. I'll accept it.
If you want to find a normal space whose Cartesian product with an interval is not normal, Now, what is a normal space? Well, first, you have to take a course in topology to find out what a topological space is. And one of the definitions, which would be totally meaningless to you, is a normal one. It's normal is one of those words in mathematics which is tremendously overused. In you have normal groups, and you have normal topological spaces, and you have normal this, that, and the other, but in all contexts it means something that you want to have, that is usually available to you. But to even understand the words in the sentences, you have to have a lot of mathematical training.
This brings up the question that I... you spoke of language.
Yes.
That you have to understand language. And do you want to... That's very interesting. I really hadn't thought that...
Well,
that
mathematics
is, language, I
is,
thought,
is in itself a language. You have...
It uses
everything.
The
it's coming off the room.
So go ahead.
Mathematics is a language, and you all the terms are ordinary English terms for the most part. Although sometimes we make up words to describe something. Usually that's more complicating than it is helpful. But we have very technical meanings for words, and you, almost every paper that you write in mathematics, you will define a new term because it's simpler to have some meaning for this, which will be useful. You'll say this is a strictly normal space. All right, strictly and normal being perfectly good English words, but you will have a very technical meaning for it, which may be used only in that particular paper, or it may be something that turns out to be so useful that it becomes standard part of the vocabulary of mathematics. And so you're constantly building mathematical vocabulary, and it's all very technical in meaning. And the area in mathematics where I work is sufficiently abstract that you find it difficult to explain to someone who's just gotten out of the calculus course what you're doing and why you're doing it. But after they've worked with the subject for, after they've learned lots and lots of definitions, they begin to see what you're doing and why you're doing it after they've been in a course in the subject for a couple of months. And it's almost impossible to tell an average layman what you're doing. On the other hand, it's a very natural thing mathematically. It's just that lots of mathematics depends on background before you can even get started.
Well, I've just made a tremendous... I picture you working on a problem and making formulae as you go along, and I suddenly realize that, in fact, what you're doing is saying to yourself, if this is so, then that, and then turning it into a 2 and a square root sign.
And actually, I don't use square roots, and I don't use numbers. I use sets and spaces. So it's in a way more like doing geometry, but it isn't geometry either. It's something else.
But it starts off with words.
With words. And you're working with words and pictures rather than with numbers. So if you were to look at a piece of paper that I've been working on, you will not see a single number or a single square root sign. You will see, you might see the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, meaning I've got sets which I'm indexing using those numbers, but I will only be using numbers to index things that I'm looking at rather than having the numbers be the things themselves.
So the pictures are in your mind.
And the pictures are mostly in your mind, but you draw pictures on your paper too, and to which symbolize something much more complicated which you're holding in your mind. But you definitely are working with words and pictures rather than with numbers.
Now, I'd like to ask you how you work. You say, when you have time, do you, as the historian or the person in English literature, does run off to the library to have a quiet space of time? Or
I have always worked on the sofa. I can only work when my feet are higher than my head. I lie down and get a piece of paper and a pencil and think and draw pictures and try to prove theorems in this way. I find it almost impossible to work at a desk. Just the uncomfortable position doesn't lend itself to me. My husband likes to sit at a table and work. Different mathematicians have different techniques of working, and many of them go to the office in order to be quiet. It helps to have some quiet. However, I have always done mathematics with a certain amount of background noise. Maybe I didn't always listen to the children when they talked to me, but I worked on mathematics when they sat on my stomach and jumped up and down.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I didn't, I just turned them off a little bit, I'm afraid. But I tried at any rate. I worked always and feel more comfortable at home with things going on a little bit around me. I almost need a little noise in order to feel that things are just right for me to work.
Mm-hmm. Does this mean that you could do it every day, or did you set aside certain...
Oh, I worked on mathematics every day, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did.
Yeah.
And you do.
Obviously. I do.
Yeah.
I always have.
But even when you... I know that you... Didn't you leave teaching for a while you had your children?
No, I didn't.
Oh.
I've always taught, and I've always taught part-time. And I like being at home, and I like doing all my own cooking, and I don't like to have someone in the house. I have always worked, I have always had someone who came in and took care of the children when I was away.
Mm-hmm.
And have had a tremendously capable, sweet, motherly woman who is better with children than I am, unquestionably, who has helped me ever since I have been in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
And it made it possible for me to have four children and to go to the university and teach and do mathematics at home.
Do you do it while you're cooking also sometimes?
Sure.
Uh-huh.
That is, but less so. I like to be sitting down when I'm working on mathematics. It almost turns me on to have a piece of paper and pencil.
Hmm.
If I have a paper and pencil, I can work in a concert at the university. I can work during someone else's lecture. I can work on the sofa at home at night with the kids coming in and out and the household activities going on. I can work if I have that paper and pencil. And my husband sometimes complains if I take my paper and pencil when we go on vacation. He feels like he ought to leave it behind. Because if I have it, I'll surely turn him off and just start to work.
And do you? There must be times when you build up. You're near to something, and then
when you're not close to solving something, you can ignore mathematics very easily. That is, you can do whatever. In fact, you find it hard to sit. If I'm at home trying to do mathematics and I'm getting nowhere with the problem, I'll get up and wash socks, and then I'll get up and wash a few dishes, and then I'll get up and get something to eat, and then I'll go make up a bed, and then I'll go. I'm tempted. I don't want to look at the mathematics. That is, I'm driven away from it because I'm not getting anywhere with it. When it's going very well, then there's almost nothing that could keep me from looking at it because I want to so badly. And so it depends on how the problem is going to how much I can concentrate and how easily I can work on it.
How do you cope with discouragement then if you aren't getting anywhere with the problem?
You just
when do you, you said after 6 months if you weren't, is that
right? Discouragement is very hard to deal with, and actually I think that's why there are very few women mathematicians. The men mathematicians, for the most part, have to have confidence because they're earning a living that way, and they maintain, they are a mathematician, they have a job as a mathematician, they can do mathematics, and even though they are discouraged over a period of time, they come back to the problem and they solve it eventually. A tremendous amount of solving problems depends on persistence. Just looking at it again, not getting it, doing the same thing again and not getting it, doing the same thing again and not getting it, again and again, until you get an idea suddenly, which changes the situation.
Because there always is a solution. Either it's that it can't there be isn't, or that it can. But
up to a point, there's always a solution. Mm-hmm. That is, you may be able to prove that it can't be solved. You may be able to prove that it's true. You may be able to prove it's false.
But you're
false,
not groping towards something that might not.
You may be groping towards something you cannot solve. I mean, that you will never... that is, you may be groping toward the impossible, in which case you should know to quit. And that's also something that people often don't know what to do, is to quit. That's the hardest thing I find to do in mathematics, is to quit. You definitely have to quit when you're, I have seen people who have this determination not to quit. Now, that's tremendously important to do mathematics. You need to be able to sustain a tremendous amount of discouragement, or you won't be able to do mathematics. But you also have to know when it's time to quit, know when you've reached a point of no return, and be able to put it down and look at something else. That's the virtue of keeping a whole group of things going at the same time, because if one of them is one of these, it doesn't matter. But if another one breaks, why, fine. Yeah. And usually if you have a whole group of them, something will lend itself
now
to
being solved. Interrupted you because you were talking about the difference between men and women, and you said men...
Men more often have the... culturally, it's built in that they have the confidence that they are a mathematician and will maintain that despite the fact that they're working on a problem that they don't get. They will look at another problem. They will get going on something else. But if you are a woman mathematician with lots of temptations to use your time and energy in another way, and that's often the situation, especially was the situation with women mathematicians of my vintage, that you were tempted to wash the socks and then you just forgot about the problem. That is, you started doing things that didn't have anything directly to do with the mathematics, and you easily... I think that women with jobs that require going to the office require... in a lab situation where you had to go to the lab to do your research, you had to go. Then they hired a babysitter. They arranged their lives so that a certain amount of time was absolutely set aside for this, and they maintained a professional attitude which gave them that same confidence which the men, by virtue of their professionalism, have. But in mathematics, it's very easy to persuade yourself that you are not getting anywhere, and that you may not, and you could obviously do it just as well at home as you could at the university. There's no reason to go to the university. There's no reason why you should do better mathematics in the library at the university than at the kitchen table at home. And so you didn't get the babysitter that was necessary for you to have the time to devote, and you perhaps didn't think of yourself in the same professional way, and having to maintain discouragement over a long period of time. There were just a lot of women who didn't have the stamina to get over that discouraging period. They started doing something else, and something else that gave them reward more quickly. And it's not surprising to me at all that they should feel this way.
The situation you're describing is the situation of any creative artist.
Yes.
That is,
right.
Painter. It has to
a painter has to have exactly the same kind of thing, or a composer, or a anyone in that kind of situation where you sort of have to wait for the muse to meet you.
And you can do it at home.
And you can do it at home, and you can do it just as well without a job, and you can do it just as well without a, you can do it just as well, except that you, it really helps to have the professional feeling that that the muse more often meets you if you have the professional feeling.
So there must be something else to being a mathematician then. I mean, that's part of it. But then there would be the, is it just the general unacceptability of women in math? Because there are women artists now and writers, many
right.
of them. So
I think that there are still relatively few women mathematicians, but there are a lot more now than there were. And it's partly because women at this time are more interested in a profession and think of it as a profession and act as though it were a profession rather than the situation with most women in my day who thought of it as something they could do at home.
Yeah.
And this makes a big difference, and there are a lot more women mathematicians now.
Yeah.
Mathematician is, I sometimes say mathematics is a social science. You definitely need to have other mathematicians who are interested in similar types of things to talk to. You are not always a good judge of what is an interesting problem, what is the right thing to do, unless you have talked to other people who are working in the same area, and their judgment on what is important and what is fundamental definitely is helpful to you, because you can become very ingrown otherwise. If you can look at a fairly large group of people who are interested in the kind of thing that you are, then you get lots of feedback on what's important. And it really is true that a number of people usually have better judgment on these things than one person does, because you get in much too much into a little corner, because you always are looking at very small problems, because that's what one person can handle. And colleagues, the University of Wisconsin is terrific because there's a huge number of mathematicians here. There's almost 90 mathematicians in the mathematics department. The statistics and computer science are completely separate, and the Mathematics Research Center is completely separate. The campus has a tremendous number of mathematicians, and I find graduate students, and I think this is true of other mathematicians too, as stimulating as colleagues, because they are tremendously interested in problems. They want to look at new papers. They have new ideas. They think of things in a different kind of way. Mathematics is, to some extent, a youthful people. Young people have lots of the best ideas. A fresh look at something is tremendously important. And so I have been tremendously influenced myself by graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
That is, when I have a student who is interested in certain kinds of things, I find I'm interested in that same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That it's very hard for me not to work on the same problems they're working on, because it becomes very exciting to look at some of the things that they see and that I didn't always notice, because my background is different.
Well, what about, do you teach undergraduates too?
Yes.
And do you get any feedback from them?
You don't get much feedback from your research from teaching 101, which I'm doing this semester. It's a course for people who didn't do well and didn't take much mathematics in high school. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have anything to do with the research mathematics, but the main thing you get out of teaching that kind of course for you as a mathematician is not contribution to your research, but the feeling that you are doing something for humanity. You need that too. You have to feel that you are contributing to society. If you're doing very abstract mathematics, and that this is the real drive in your life, it really isn't a bad idea to have something very concrete that obviously is helpful to the average citizen that you do to get rewards of the kind that you get from feeling that you're doing something for people. And it sort of earns you the right then to do the thing that gives you super joy, namely the mathematics, which is an aesthetic thing which you can only share with a relatively small group. You really can't tell the man on the street what you're doing. Mathematical wives at parties have a hard time because the mathematicians are apt to start talking about mathematics, and they have been through this process so often of not understanding a word that was being said. It can really get to you. But I have had very good contact with some of the people in the department here. That is, that we work on in different areas of mathematics. Mm-hmm. For instance, we have a very strong group of logicians. And the kind of mathematics I do is tremendously influenced by the fact that we have a very strong group of logicians here.
So you
I have moved over into problems that are almost logic because I talk to them about my topological problems and they make suggestions which use their techniques from logic, and very quickly I'm looking at problems that are almost logic. So
people mind sharing their ideas
of that? Oh no, not at all. It used to be that the man I studied with considered ideas a tremendously private thing which you could steal from someone else. You should always give credit whenever you use the idea of someone else. And to some extent, we always try to do that. Mathematicians try to say, this idea was suggested to me by so-and-so, and it works very effectively here. But it's very hard to trace where ideas come from. And you do more mathematics and prettier mathematics when there are a whole group of you working in the same area. And then you really can't tell exactly where a particular idea came from.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very hard to give credit where credit is sometimes due.
But in any case, you're the one who did finally solve the
problem.
Yes, so,
right.
Yeah.
Frequently, you are the person who solved the problem because you talked to someone else about it who suggested looking at another idea which you hadn't thought about, which worked.
Mm-hmm.
I am not a great writer. I don't particularly like to write. My husband writes very well and has written quite a few books in addition to lots of mathematical papers, but I do relatively little writing. I do a lot of lecturing, however. Give a lot of colloquia, give a lot of series of lectures. And this is the kind of thing that you usually do not write out, because mathematics is somewhat different from history in that instead of producing literature which you read in this form, you usually prove a theorem which requires time to think about one sentence to the next sentence to the next sentence, and so you usually write the sentences more or less on the board for people to think about, and you talk about it a little bit, write another sentence on the board, write another sentence on the board, but you do not write it out in advance. You respond to questions. It isn't the kind of thing where it's fixed in in advance. You do not usually give lectures that are, even when you're lecturing to a meeting of the American Mathematical Society, let's say, you wouldn't necessarily write out every word that you were going to say. You would carefully think about what you were going to say. You would carefully outline it. You might make some transparencies to put on a board for people to look at. But you wouldn't put too much on them, and you would keep it so that someone could keep the understanding of what you're saying. That's the tremendously important thing. And usually the ideas are sufficiently complicated that you need a little time to think about them in between.
Mm-hmm.
And so mathematical lecturing is quite different from...
It must be very slow.
Some other kind. It's very slow. It's slow.
Uh-huh.
And it's quite different from giving a lecture in some other fields.
And none of the rest of us will ever know that because we won't ever go to one.
And it's convenient to be married to a mathematician because we both frequently want to go to the same international congress in Finland, while a wife who was not a mathematician might have preferred to go to someplace else instead because she would like to have her husband go along.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up with taking vacations that involve going to conferences.
Mm-hmm.
But you might worry also that you would have conflicts because one of you might prove a theorem and the other one might not, or you might both want a job in the same mathematics department and not be able to get it, or you might there would be other difficulties that you would run into. But we found it very... it really hasn't been a problem for us.
Mm-hmm.
We work in entirely different kinds of mathematics, and we have always had jobs very easily with no problems, and so it hasn't been a problem for us.
And very clearly, you haven't had to subserve yourself.
Oh, no.
I just say this because I was talking...
That it is a problem when the wife is a much stronger mathematician than the husband. Mathematicians are inclined to linearly order each other, and they are willing to say this person is better than that person.
Uh-huh.
I don't think historians are necessarily linearly ordered, and mathematicians really aren't either, but to some extent you can say this person is doing more mathematics than that one, this one is doing more important theorems than that one. And to whatever extent that is true, and the wife is much better than the husband, I think this is very hard to live with in our culture.
For the husband.
Right.
And the wife doesn't mind.
Well, maybe even for the wife.
Hmm.
Maybe for both of them, for everybody involved. Even the professional members of the department don't want to find themselves in the position where the... wife is noticeably better than the husband in the same field. I think that's very hard to live with in our culture. And but the truth is that usually you find a way around it. You do different kinds of things. And but you sometimes have to find a way around it when that situation exists. It really helps to be perfectly comfortable, to be just as good as you possibly can be. And that isn't always the case.
It isn't always possible.